From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, just hours after Russian officials are slapped with sanctions, President Putin signs Crimea's future under Russian sovereignty.
The actual transition of Crimea may now take several months as the rules in that region need to be changed to adopt the Russian ruble, social benefits, tax requirements and other Russian legislation.
Also today, Turkey's Prime Minister attempts to turn the lights out on the nation's Twitter sphere. A former FBI aviation investigator gives us his take on the missing Malaysian airliner. And as the trial of Paralympic star Oscar Pistorius heads for a fourth week, we examine South Africa's gated community culture.
The first night I was in South Africa, the host of where I was staying, I got up to do what one does in the middle of the night and was attacked.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Hume. Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed into law the absorption of Crimea into the Russian Federation and amended the country's constitution. The EU and the US say the annexation of Crimea is illegal and have hit Moscow with sanctions over its actions in the region. Tom Barton is in Crimea. He says the area is already changing visibly.
I'm stood here outside the naval headquarters in Simferopol, the regional capital of Crimea, looking at a Russian armoured personnel carrier and soldiers on one gate, and an armoured car and more soldiers on the other. Around them are so-called self-defence battalions. Here, I've just witnessed them tear off some of the Ukrainian state symbols from the front of the base. Russian soldiers, although Moscow denies they're Russian soldiers still, took control of two Ukrainian ships in Sevastopol.
Meanwhile, the European Union and Ukraine have signed a political association agreement in Brussels. It allows for the opening up of trade links between the two sides. The agreement is key in formalising European solidarity with the interim government in Kiev. Turkey's president, Abdullah Gül, has challenged a ban of Twitter that was ordered by Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Thursday. The move to ban the microblog service has sparked public condemnation across the country. Mr. Gül, in his apparent evasion of the ban, took to Twitter saying the shutdown was unacceptable. Prime Minister Erdogan has vowed to wipe out the microblog after users posted documents pertaining to alleged corruption in his inner circle. Alexander Christie Miller is a Turkey-based journalist for The Times of London.
Internet users are very used to using software which allows them to bypass this. So you have a situation where even the president and members of the government are still tweeting by this so-called ban. Having said that, I've spoken to some experts who believe that this is just the first step in what could be a far more comprehensive effort to control internet usage.
The first ever UK prosecutions over female genital mutilation have been announced by officials in London. The Crown Prosecution Service has charged a doctor and one other man with offences relating to FGM. Our UK correspondent Dan Whitehead reports.
The CPS says after looking at evidence from the Metropolitan Police, it will prosecute 31-year-old Dr. Danison Damascena from East London for an alleged offence while working at a hospital in the north of the capital back in 2012. Another man, Hassan Mohammed, has been charged with intentionally encouraging female genital mutilation. The charges have been brought under the FGM Act of 2003, with the charges carrying a maximum prison term of 14 years. Dan Whitehead, London.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A second day of searching for the missing Malaysian airliner MH370 has concluded without any debris sightings in the southern Indian Ocean. Australian officials say they will resume again on Saturday, with additional vessels joining the search, including Australian Navy ship HMAS Success. Uruguay's president, José Mujica, has agreed to take five Guantanamo inmates as the White House moves to find alternatives to closing the detention centre. Guantanamo originally opened after 9/11 to imprison people linked to the terror attacks on New York's World Trade Center. However, Uruguay's U.S. ambassador, Julissa Reynoso, denies any deal has been made and says they're still discussing the issue. From Washington, Andrea Arenas reports.
President José Mujica said he had accepted the request and would consider the five men as refugees in the country. The Obama administration has promised to free all of the 154 inmates remaining in the camp. Since President Obama took office, the State Department has resettled 43 detainees in 17 countries and has released 38 of them to their countries of origin. Andrea Arenas, Washington.
Around 200,000 missing digital bitcoins on the Tokyo-based Mt. Gox exchange have now been found, but the whereabouts of hundreds of thousands more are still unknown. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent Alice Olstein reports.
The recovered coins, found in a digital wallet the company had thought was empty, are worth about $114 million. But the Tokyo-based exchange is still on the edge of collapse, having declared bankruptcy earlier this year and continuing to battle a class-action lawsuit from individual holders, accusing them of embezzlement and seeking to freeze their executives' U.S. assets. Alice Olstein, Washington.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Hume reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Our interest was in more fully integrating Russia politically and economically into Europe and into, indeed, the fabric of the international system. But that was predicated on an expectation that Russia would play by the rules of the road, the economic and security rules of the road, international law, and the norms and principles that govern responsible international action. What we have seen in Ukraine is obviously a very egregious departure from that.
National Security Advisor Susan Rice giving her assessment Friday on Russia's intervention in Ukraine. Earlier, President Vladimir Putin put pen to paper and signed a law finalising bringing Crimea under Russian sovereignty. That signature just 24 hours after the US and EU expanded targeted sanctions against Russian officials, hitting them with asset freezes and travel bans. For more, I spoke to our Moscow correspondent Anya Ardaeva.
Russian President Vladimir Putin signed both the amendment to the Russian Constitution, which allows for swift incorporation of Crimea into Russia, as well as an international treaty with Crimea and the city of Sevastopol. The ceremony was broadcast live on Russia's national television. The actual transition of Crimea may now take several months, as the rules in that region need to be changed to adopt the Russian ruble, social benefits, tax requirements, and other Russian legislation, so it may take until next year before that region is fully incorporated into Russia.
Anya, how have the Russians blacklisted by the US and the likes of the senior ministers in the Kremlin reacted to yesterday's announcement?
The Russian senators passed a statement in response to the US and EU sanctions, and in that statement they called the measures an unprecedented move of political blackmail and asked for all senators to be included to the sanctions list. So this just reflects the attitude here among the Russian officials towards the sanctions. The statement also called for the West to urgently offer help to Ukraine and said that it's time not for imposing sanctions, but to act urgently and offer targeted help to the Ukrainian people. This follows a statement from the Russian foreign minister Sergei Lavrov, who called the sanctions absolutely unlawful and said it would create artificial barriers with the West.
Senator John McCain said appearing on Russia's own blacklist was a badge of honour. Does Moscow have any plans to further attempt to punish the United States? Perhaps something that they take more seriously?
It's not clear at this point what exactly the Russian government is planning to do, as there are various and conflicting opinions voiced by the Russian officials. The Russian finance minister Anton Siluvanov said on Friday Russia may stop borrowing money. The Russian finance minister Anton Siluvanov said on Friday that Russia may stop borrowing money abroad this year in response to the U.S. sanctions, adding that it planned to borrow about $7 billion in foreign banks. Russian President Vladimir Putin, meanwhile, assured that Russia will refrain from tit-for-tat sanctions against the U.S. He also mocked U.S. sanctions, saying he will now open an account with Rossiya Bank, which was earlier sanctioned by Washington.
Anya Ardaeva in Moscow. The European Union has signed an association with the new interim Ukrainian government. The political step reveals clear support for Ukraine's fledgling administration and should see the opening up of trade links to help boost the country's struggling economy. It also coincides with additional Russian names being added to a list of EU sanctions. From Brussels, Jack Parrock reports.
Ukraine's interim Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk came to Brussels to sign an association agreement with the European Union. He spoke out strongly against Russia and says he expects the support of the EU.
You need to pay the price, and we all need to pay the price for peace, stability, security, and values. And I strongly believe that the EU acknowledges this, realizes this, and the EU will speak in one single and strong voice, protecting the values, defending the territorial integrity of Ukraine, and protecting actually the EU itself.
The signing of the association agreement is significant. Former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to turn his back on the deal was the original cause of the uprising in Ukraine. The new Prime Minister's visit coincides with the summit of the European Council, where the 28 leaders of the EU member states have agreed to impose further sanctions on top Russian officials for their part in the annexation of the Crimean Peninsula. EU leaders say they are now ready to step up measures even further if necessary.
The European Council recalls that any further steps by the Russian Federation to destabilize the situation in Ukraine would lead to additional and far-reaching consequences for relations in a broad range of economic areas between the European Union and its member states on one hand and the Russian Federation on the other hand. In this respect, the European Council asks the Commission and the member states to prepare possible target measures.
That was European Commission President José Manuel Barroso. Parts of the European Union are dependent on Russian gas imports, so broad economic sanctions could hit places like the Baltic nations, for instance, very hard. But there is a general feeling that Europe's strongest hand is to remind Russia that their economy is also EU-dependent, and if they can trump President Putin with a direct threat to his economy, he may be forced to de-escalate the current situation. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
This is FSN Reports. We'll eradicate Twitter. I don't care what the international community says. Everyone will witness the power of the Turkish Republic. Those are the words of Turkey Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan shortly before Twitter was effectively switched off. The ban brought about by a court order was forced through after recordings, seemingly involving Erdogan, surfaced on the social media site, triggering accusations of corruption involving the Prime Minister and his son. The country's president, however, expressed via Twitter his hope that the government's ban would be short-lived. For more on the allegations levelled at the Prime Minister and the resulting censorship of Twitter, I spoke to Alexander Christy Miller, Turkey-based reporter for the Christian Science Monitor.
Yesterday afternoon, Prime Minister Erdogan made a speech vowing to wipe out Twitter, saying he didn't care about the reaction of the international community. He was going to show the world Turkey's strength. Within a few hours, Twitter had been totally blocked in Turkey. As we later found out, it was through an order by a government body, which has recently been granted sweeping new internet censorship powers under a recent law. Really, what's behind this is that for the past several weeks, Turkey's been rocked by a number of very, very damaging alleged phone calls between different senior government figures, including Mr. Erdogan, which have been leaked online and disseminated using Twitter and other social media websites. There are local elections coming up in just a week's time, and there's a big expectation here that further damaging allegations could be revealed between now and then. Everyone seems to think that Erdogan's desperate to prevent these revelations from spreading, and this is what's brought about this action today.
Alexander, can you give us an idea of what the quality of democracy is like in Turkey today? Because these sorts of actions we would more commonly associate with oppressive regimes and dictatorships, right?
This Twitter ban puts Turkey in a pretty unenviable club of countries which have done similar things. Turkey, as recently as two years ago, Turkey was being praised for the democratic progress that it's made under Erdogan. It's a candidate country for EU membership, and actually it has a long history of democracy, albeit democracy with a shadow of authoritarian rule and at periods dictatorship. that really what's happened in the past, over the past kind of 3 years, is that the government, and particularly Erdogan, has grown increasingly authoritarian. In 2011, he won a very, very commanding general election victory. And really, since that point, he's been able to do as he wishes. What's happened in the last sort of 8 months or so is that there's basically been a popular backlash, first a popular backlash to his sort of authoritarian tendencies in the form of summer protests, in the form of anti-government protests last summer. And then more recently, the government's main ally and really the only organization in the country which really has the sort of power to stand up to him has turned against him. This is a movement headed by a Pennsylvania-based imam called Fethullah Gulen, and his network is very powerful in Turkey, and they're widely believed to be the ones who are bringing out these damaging leaks. And really, Erdogan's response to these two different threats, the threat from the streets and the threat from the Fethullah Gulen organization, has been to dramatically expand the powers of the state. And this Twitter ban is the latest manifestation of this.
Alexander Christie Miller in Turkey.
And we've been throwing everything we've got at that area to try to learn more about what this debris might be. Now, it could just be a container that's fallen off a ship. We just don't know.
Australian Prime Minister Tony Abbott on the intensified search for Flight 370 in waters some 1,500 miles southwest of Perth in the southern Indian Ocean, following the release of new satellite images supposedly showing unidentified floating objects in the area. More than a dozen ships and aircraft have been dispatched for the search, including a US surveillance plane. To discuss the challenges ahead if and when the passenger jet is found, I spoke to James Kallstrom, part of the FBI's investigation team into the TWA 800 air disaster.
The summer of 96, TWA Flight 800, 747, exactly the fourth one ever built by Boeing, leaving John F. Kennedy Airport in New York, heading to Paris, France, and about 10 minutes into its flight, it blew up in a massive fireball, killing all 229 people aboard.
Are there parallels that your experience with that investigation that you expect to see occur if and when this aircraft is found?
If it actually went in the water, either by suicide by airplane or if there was some catastrophic event that caused the plane to blow up, then over water, then the one parallel would be that recovering an aircraft in water, which is very, very difficult. And I was lucky to be only in 130 feet of water, and I had the access to the entire U.S. Navy to help me. So here we have multiple countries and much, much deeper water. But it's looking more and more, in my view, that the airplane is not in the water.
Can I ask you, how did reclaiming the black boxes in the case of TWA 800 assist that investigation?
It actually didn't help us anything. When we recovered the boxes about day five, we had hoped it would tell us something, but there's a cockpit voice recorder recording the voices of the pilots, and then there's a data recorder recording the streams of data on the airline mechanical, electrical, and the engines and all that. And everything was perfectly normal, and all of a sudden it just went dead, boom, and that's when the catastrophic explosion took place. So it didn't really tell us anything at all about what caused the explosion.
Do you think there's a case that perhaps the technology to locate and understand what happens to an aircraft that's met some form of disaster is outmoded and outdated?
I think it's definitely going to show that, along with the fact that, you know, some countries in the world are just not up to the, you know, the experience level and the ability to conduct these types of investigations. And when you lose 3 or 4 or 5 days or a week, you know, this investigation is built on a sandy foundation, quite frankly. There's not a whole lot of facts that we really know for certain. But I think as we move into the future, we're going to have almost real-time or semi-real-time, you know, streaming to satellites. Either that or some sort of ejection capsule that would leave the airplane with its own tracking beacon that would float on the water, something like that. Many military planes have full streaming, frequency audio up to satellites and back. The airlines really don't want to do that because it's very expensive for the satellite time, but I suspect we're going to be getting closer and closer to that. That's where it's leaning.
James Kallstrom, former FBI aviation investigator. Now, Oscar Pistorius, the Paralympic star accused of the murder of his girlfriend, is attempting to sell his Pretoria home to tackle rising legal costs. That's according to a statement on his website. Pistorius pleaded not guilty to intentionally killing his girlfriend, Reva Steenkamp, on Valentine's Day last year. He maintains he mistook her for an intruder when he shot her behind a locked bathroom door. Our Africa correspondent, Gary Alfonso, has been following the trial, now entering a fourth week.
Well, what the court heard was the testimony from the policemen who were on the scene first and who basically from a forensics perspective looked at the bullet holes and the trajectory of the bullet holes. Not only that, but also the distance from which it could possibly have been fired and also from which height it was fired. And as it turned out, there could only be conclusive evidence from one of the bullets because only one of the bullets actually hit the wall behind Reva Steenkamp. The rest obviously hit the model herself, and that cast some doubt into the entire state's argument that he might have been on his prosthetics when those shots were fired.
And there were some graphic images to support that ballistic evidence of the crime scene, the victim, and of Oscar Pistorius, the defendant.
Yes, this caused perhaps the most turmoil in the court, and Oscar Pistorius himself throwing up on two occasions, on other occasions closing his ears and not wanting to hear about the testimony, and in other cases, really what many people feel is sloppy work in court by the police forensics departments who simply scroll past pictures of the deceased in order to get to a different file of pictures and showing pictures of Reva Steenkamp as she was lying there, you know, with severe wounds and blood everywhere. And this caused not only the family of Reva Steenkamp who was there, her mother returned for it and actually stormed out of the court when that happened, but it also caused some uneasiness among the people in court saying, you know, whether it was really necessary or whether something like that could have been perhaps planned a little bit better, because it was very graphic for those in court and obviously also very traumatic to see those moments as most policemen would now being made very public.
But of course you don't actually have to be in court to hear that testimony, because this case is being broadcast on television screens across South Africa. How has the general public there judged the coverage so far?
Well, the response has been absolutely overwhelming. The private company that is basically contracted to run the satellite television company that's contracted to run this broadcast has received an overwhelming response to people wanting to basically subscribe to the service. And also radio and television numbers are seeing record numbers in viewership in the past 2-3 weeks. So it's definitely taken off, and there's definitely a very high interest. Another interesting aspect is that media monitoring organizations are finding a very big discrepancy between what news organizations report at the end of day when it comes to what their overview or their perspectives were of what happened in court case, as opposed to those people who are watching minute by minute or listening minute by minute or even following it on social media like Twitter. So that's an interesting perspective.
Gary Alfonso. One of the theories surrounding the shooting death of Reva Steenkamp is that Pistorius felt threatened in his house and believed she was an intruder. The house where the shooting occurred is in Pretoria, South Africa, and has been described as a high-security gated complex. For a closer look at the gated community in South Africa, I spoke to Matthew Darrington, cultural anthropologist at Towson University, Maryland.
Gated communities are a global phenomenon. They're usually surrounded by a variety of different security measures, from walls to razor wire electrified fences. Also security guards who are controlling who comes in and out of that controlled space. And then within the gated community itself, each home tends to have burglar alarms, bars, and other security measures in place. So that's atypical of most gated communities globally. What you're going to find, folks that live in gated communities, you have a number of different amenities that are there, some of the typical ones would be a golf course probably enclosed within the community. Other types of lifestyle amenities, maybe a business park, gas station, nursery, daycare. But they've expanded to such a degree that some of us who do research on gated communities are starting to postulate that one could be born, go to school, live, work, and die in a gated community. It's a means by which some folks have segregated themselves in the new South African and other countries as well. I have a colleague at the University of KwaZulu-Natal named Richard Ballard who talks about the movement of majority affluent whites into gated communities in South Africa as semigration. It's not immigration. They're not leaving the country, but they're essentially checking out of South African citizenship by closing themselves off, cloistering themselves in these type of gated communities and not dealing with or facing a lot of the different challenges and opportunities that come in a new democratized state such as South Africa.
The fear of crime, that's universal. And if you have money at your disposal, people will often take measures to protect themselves and their families. Are there parallels in the US to what we see in South Africa?
Not probably to the extent of large swath lifestyle communities that take up a lot of space. If anything, in South Africa, the city of Durban is an example. North of the city, there's a lot of area to be developed. You see some of this in the South in terms of the United States, where it's part of suburban sprawl. You may have these type of estates or what have you. Folks may say that it's for security, but the majority of researchers that look at gated community developments in the United States, most people that live in these communities are doing it as a sign of affluence, as a sign of a class status.
Part of the defense in the Oscar Pistorius trial is this paranoia, this threat that he was living under in this gated community. Are they impenetrable or are they vulnerable? Is crime still being committed in these environments?
Are they vulnerable? Any space is vulnerable. Do people scale the walls? Sure. You get the sense from talking with individuals that there is this notion of an inevitable victimization. My opinion, if you will, is that folks in South Africa, perhaps of a certain class status, but maybe beyond that, could empathize with the position that the defense is taking, and that they can think about someone who responded to a potential crime within their house based on, if not the paranoia, the fear of crime that's omnipresent. Mm-hmm. The first night I was in South Africa, the host of where I was staying, I got up to do what one does in the middle of the night and was attacked. This is a friend of mine, but was under such a paranoid state when they heard something middle of the night, came after me in a hallway. So for me, that was always it basically set the tone in some ways for my research in South Africa, that literally the first night I was in the country, someone overreacted to a possible crime threat within their house. And I don't want to dismiss or discount real crime. And we have to respect the fact that crime statistics, being what they are in South Africa, are much different than in other industrialized nations such as the United States, where crime isn't occurring on the level that it is. But what I would want to question is that crime happening to the population and to those places where gated communities exist?
Matthew Darrington, cultural anthropologist at Towson University, Maryland. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of the show by emailing us, reports@featurestory.com. And we're on Twitter, @FeatureStory. Coming up on Monday, all the latest events surrounding the Ukrainian crisis and that continuing search for the plane and passengers of Flight 370. That's Monday. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Hume on the bulletin desk. For everyone, with Feature Story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.